Good morning. Before I introduce our speaker, I'd just say a personal comment. This meeting's kind of a watershed for me. I'm an alum of Wheaton College, so it's great to be back here. Very nostalgic. Also, a lot of the old timers will see my name and they'll say, "Everest, are you Elton's grandson?" I'm like, "Yes, I'm Elton's grandson." This is the first meeting, though, where more than one person, happened more than once, but it's the first meeting where someone's come up to me and said, "Everest, are you Thomas's dad?" So it's a pivotal meeting for me. So yes, I am Thomas's dad. I was joking last night. I could take some credit for my son. I can't take any credit for my grandfather. I am honored to be able to introduce to you Dr. James Shirley. He's spent a career elucidating mechanisms responsible for the specialized renewal properties of adult stem cells and using that knowledge to address major research problems limiting the development of adult stem cells for biomedicine. He's won numerous awards and accolades, including Pew Scholars in Biomedical Research Award, the Ellison Medical Foundation Senior Scholar Award in Aging Research, and the NIH Director's Pioneer Award. Dr. Shirley graduated with a degree in biology from Harvard, completed MD-PhD at Johns Hopkins, after which he did postdoctoral work at Princeton. Following that, he was a principal investigator at Fox Chase Cancer Center in Philadelphia. It's a national lab, is that right? Is that a national lab, Fox Chase? And then joined the faculty at MIT in the Department of Biological Engineering. Following that, he was a senior scientist at the Boston Biomedical Research Institute. And I understand that his talk this morning is going to be largely autobiographical, so I hope I'm not giving your talk for you. But I'm sure he has some details to add to this trajectory. In 2009, he became the director of the Adult Stem Cell Technology Center, which later became Asymmetrix, where a company where he is currently the director. Their mission is to advance emerging adult stem cell tissue technologies to applications in clinical drug discovery and cellular medicine. A laudable mission for a company. Asymmetrix has many recently issued patents for biotechnologies for the quantification and production of human adult tissue stem cells. So that's all the stuff I did on background research on him. But since that was before I met him, having met him now at this meeting, interacted just a little bit over a meal and in passing, I have to say I'm so impressed. He's a man of principled convictions, has a keen intellect, a gentle spirit, and a delightful presence. If you have a chance, get to know him over the course of the meeting. It's really been a delight to get to know you just a little bit, and I look forward to hearing what you have to tell us this morning. Welcome, Dr. Shirley.
Good morning. Good morning. So I want to first thank Michael for that introduction, especially the end of it. And I really have enjoyed talking with you too, and those who I've met so far. I guess my slides will come up in a minute. I want to start off by just saying thank you to the organizers of the meeting to give me this opportunity to share with you this morning. I want to give a special thanks to the ASA members out at the Boston Roundtable who I think kind of orchestrated me having this opportunity. And I'm going to share with you today, personally, because it's a rare opportunity to do this in this setting around the thing that I've spent all my life doing, which is being a scientist. So I really appreciate the opportunity, and I want to tell you too that when Robin sent me the email invitation for this, she told me in the email, in our communications, that I could talk about whatever I wanted to, but she suggested to me that I talk about my life as a scientist, as a Christian. And I've not had that opportunity to do that publicly before. And so at first, I have to say, I was like, I don't know. But the Lord guided me in this, and I'm convinced that the right thing to do is what I'm going to try to do today. So could I get those slides up, please? Yes. I don't know where this is actually going to go, because I'll just tell you, when you review your own life for the sake of sharing with others, you go over some grounds that were joyful and some grounds that were painful. And so I hope I can get through this okay today. So far things are going all right.
Yes, that's it there.
All right, so the topic of my sharing this morning is living a scientist's life. The scientist's life I'm going to tell you about is my own. And I do want to tell you from the perspective of what it's meant to be a person of faith and to become a scientist as well. And I'm hopeful that this one life will have relevance to all the lives that are here and the ones that you touch. I think it will, because we are all in the body of Christ. And because of that, I'm sure that there are going to be some issues that I encountered that will resonate with you. But I'm a unique person, as you're unique people, and there'll be some things that may not be so familiar, but that's an opportunity again for us to share. I particularly have been planning this talk for the 40 or so young scientists that are in this room. And I hope that it will be helpful to you in terms of thinking about how to negotiate whatever the advantages and the challenges you have in your own careers as you move forward in science. I want to start with Ford. And if you've had an opportunity to read my abstract, I say at the end of it that I was born to be a scientist. Now, I want you to understand that there's sort of two aspects of that. One of them is general. I'll tell you about that in a minute and how I think about it. And the other one is specific, is how I came into being a scientist. And it's important because how I came into being a scientist reflects the Christ in my life. And my early support as a scientist is in the environment of the church. But let's talk about the general first. It is the nature of being human beings to be scientists. We all start off understanding and learning about our world by investigating it, experimenting with it, drawing conclusions about it, and then testing it. You all discovered gravity before Einstein. You ever heard of Einstein? Right, we've all seen small children push things off of tables or their feeding trays and watch it fall. They discover that. And then they learn that they can actually do awkward behavior training, right, by doing it and have somebody keep picking it up for them. And then after that, they discover that, they think then, you know, things are pretty predictable here. If I push this off, you know, dad or mom or sister or brother's going to pick it up and put it back up here. Gravity's reversible, right? And then they learn that the world is not predictable, because at some point, the person picking it up stops doing it. And maybe even takes the toy away. So so the difference between everyone and those of us who are trained in this profession is twofold. One, we have this special training. We spent learning how science, the codes of science, the practices of science, we understand that, we practice, apply it. And then the other thing is that we're about the business of discovering new things about the world. But human beings understand the scientific method inherently in our humanity. It's the gift that God has given us. But we're about making the world, the knowledge, bigger and more involved in understanding it. Now, my birth as a scientist comes from both what I actually remember and also what I've been told about when I was a kid. Right, so my parents were sharecroppers of a farm, Pearson's Farm in Memphis, Tennessee, outside of Memphis, Tennessee. And we picked the cotton fields there. And when I was a small boy, I still remember going to the cotton fields with my mother. We were given these grocery bags, and we were supposed to be picking cotton, too, just to keep us out of trouble. Me and my sister, who's 2 years older, about 3 or 4 years old at that time. And so I would pick in cotton. My bag would be full of insects. And I tried to take him into the house, and my mom wouldn't let me. That's who I was then. Now, there was a big oak tree in front of our house, and that oak tree had carpenter ants in it. And when I was, again, about 3 or 4, I used to go out and squat and watch the ants. And the ants would discover me as I discovered them. And I'd invariably get ants stuck to my neck, biting me on my legs, and I'd run to my mom, and my mom would pick them up. And she got tired of this behavior of her child, and she would say to me, "Stay away from that tree." And what my mom's younger brother, Uncle Charlie, used to tell me is that my grandmother said, "Ruby Lee, leave that boy alone. He's going to be a scientist." That's the first I've heard of that. And from that day forward, I am the scientist in our family. Everyone knows that about James. And I just want to tell you that that oak tree, for many years, stood there. And I would come home after I started college, and I would drive by, and the houses that used to be there and the cotton fields that used to be there was gone, but that oak tree was there. Now, in addition to that oak tree, about 3 or 4 miles away, at the end of the cotton fields, was a church called the Oakville Missionary Baptist Church. And I've been told that when I was a young child, my mom used to put me on her hip and take my older sister Josie by the hand and walk that 3 to 4 miles to go to church every Sunday. And that church is a part of my entire life, from my birth until we moved away to the city. My father got a job as a cement mason, and but we've always been a part of Oakville, and Oakville is still there. And I'm still a member of it. It's the one place where I have a church membership is at my home church at Oakville. And at Oakville is where I was really nourished toward a career in science. My pastor was a chemist, and I got all of the support around James as a scientist. We just put on these African-American history pageants. I was George Washington Carver. So my science starts in the church, was supported by the church from the very, very beginning. So what I want to turn to now, I'm purposely getting ahead of myself. I want to tell you about the scientists that, as I look back, that represent the role models, if you will, the visions for me to become a scientist. And these are probably the most important names I think about right now, and I just want to go through those. So Carver is George Washington Carver, and as I said growing up, the only scientist I knew about was George Washington Carver. I discovered him in fourth grade reading a biography about him. And I don't remember about the science that he was supposed to do. What I remember is that he was taken away from his mother because of slavery at the time. He was separated from his mom. His mom was taken away from him. That always sort of stayed with me. Now, I've heard since then, as I've gotten older, that George Washington Carver, maybe his science wasn't sort of all of that, but what I think was most important about the work of George Washington Carver is that he showed that black people could be scientists too. You'll see why that's important for me. Now, you probably don't know Josie as a scientist. That's my older sister. She's 2 years older than I am. She always did everything first. I can remember when she first went to school and I couldn't go, I cried because I couldn't go. But she's the one who really got me focused on what path in science I was going to take, because she came home when she was in sixth grade. She had taken a health class, and she had learned about these invisible organisms called bacteria. And I still remember my amazement. She was like, "James, they're everywhere. They're on your skin. They're in your mouth. They're in our food. Bacteria, bacteria." So how do you see these bacteria? She says, "Well, I think you have to get something called a microscope or something." And I decided in that moment that I was going to grow up and study bacteria. And when I left for college many years later, I went to college to become a scientist, a microbiologist. Right? So Josie has really been a very important person in my life. She's an avid reader. The reading I learned to do is because of following her lead. Now, Just is Ernest Everett Just, black marine biologist, lived at the turn of the 20th century. I didn't discover him until my time as a scientist when I was actually going to MIT. My wife's godmother got me a book that was written by this person, this author, Kenneth Manning. It's a biography of E.E. Just, Black Apollo of Science. I'll come back later and tell you why that's significant for me. But it turns out that Manning was at MIT. I met him there. He ended up being an advocate for me. The life of E.E. Just, 100 years earlier, as far as I can tell, looks just like my experience in science. Right? And then finally on this list of importance for me is Thomas Kuhn. If you haven't read The Structure of Scientific Revolutions, I encourage you to do so. I discovered this book in a trash bin. I was helping one of my graduate school friends move. He was moving on. And in his wastebasket was this paperback book called The Structure of Scientific Revolutions. I said, Phil, why are you throwing this out? He goes, oh, no, I don't need it anymore. I says, well, you know, can I have it? And I'll tell you, I have this thing about books. I can't stand to see them being thrown out. If I'm walking by a library and I see a stack of books there, they're going home with me. I'll look at them later, and I've got a lot of those kinds of, like, you know, stray books at home. But I picked that book up and I put it on the shelf, and I didn't look at it until later in my graduate career when I was struggling with what I felt was the lack of acceptance for my new ideas. And the postdoc in our lab said, James, you know, you should read Structure of Scientific Revolutions. You'll have a better understanding of what you're encountering. The new ideas in science, although they're about innovation, always have a tough way to go to acceptance. It's the nature of science, the way science moves forward. That's been really helpful to me in another way that I'll come to later. So what I want to share, the theme of my talk today in terms of being a scientist and a person of faith, is tension between the two, science and religion versus synthesis. And the theme that I'm going to leave with you that I think that characterizes my experience as a scientist is the latter, synthesis, not the tension. Now, we heard some talk earlier here about this idea that science and religion are at odds, they're in battle, they're against one another. There's a long history of this problem between the church and science, but a lot of science has come out of the church. And what I submit is that, and I think a lot of people, this is what's nice about being here, is that there's no reason that science and religion have to be at odds with one another. They are both from God. There can be a synthesis of that. And I hope you'll see, as I take you through my experience, how that synthesis has come about. So that tension, though, did exist for me from the outside. So when I got ready to head out to college, there was this discussion in the Oakville Missionary Baptist Church about James and maybe forgetting about God when he went off to college. I was never concerned about that. And my father, who was associate pastor in the church, my Sunday school teacher, a very obviously important person in my life, wasn't worried about it either. We weren't concerned about it, but other people were. You know, folks went off to college, they came back, they didn't go to church anymore, and they lost their faith. This was a threat to us. So this idea of science versus faith was even worse for me going off to college, because I wasn't just going off to college to do anything. I was going off to college to become a scientist, to be critical, perhaps, of the faith. And again, I'll tell you, that has never really been an issue for me. And I think over time, people in my church family who are concerned about it understand it doesn't have to be that way. Now, the one thing sharing with the younger people here that I did lose when I went to college is fellowship. If I look back at my life as a Christian and you were to ask me, what thing might you do differently? I think I would work harder at continuing the participation in the church family that I grew up with. But I tell you, when I got to Harvard College, I did not go to church for a very long time. I didn't lose my faith at all. My prayers, the way I think about the world in terms of God's role in it, but my participation in fellowship just went to zero. And it didn't come back. And then, you know, when I look at that, I wasn't protesting, I just didn't go. It's easy when you're in the kinds of places I've gone to college not to go to church. I wonder what it would be like to be in a place like a Wheaton College, which I'm learning about. I wonder what that's going to that would be like. But when I had children, this became a very important concern of mine. And the way I put it is this. In my life, my religion was inherited. The people I grew up with, my parents, it is their world. And all of the children there, just as we inherited their genes, we inherited their faith. Yes, we grew up in the church with learning and education. Basically, it was something that we started with. We didn't discover it. And I have met people in the world who had not started that way and then discovered Christ. And as I thought about my children, the question was, should we bestow and let them inherit religion the way my wife and I had, or should we let them discover it? And we did something kind of in between, because we started going to church, and we joined the church family, and my kids got a chance to grow up in Sunday school. But as they got older and got into their teen years, we didn't make that a requirement as it was in my own home. We let them start to decide for themselves how they wanted to know Christ. We were available to them, we support them, but again, so now that the kids are out of the house and on their own, I'm back to where I was. Some of my difficulties with congregational church on a regular basis is that people are people. And, you know, if you are a member of a congregation, you know that there are many challenges in terms of being a part of that. So I still struggle with finding the right church home. I love going back to my home church. Even this morning, the power of togetherness and fellowship is just an amazing thing. It always reaches me. But I still haven't figured that out. My wife is a church every Sunday, but she's not a member of the church that she belongs to. Right? So we still are trying to figure that part out about fellowship, but I know it's important. That's been a challenge for me. So what I want to turn to now is what I identify as the main challenges I've had as being a scientist in my scientist life, and also in being a scientist in my faith and how my faith has played a role. That's how I'm going to spend the rest of my time. So there are four aspects of this that I want to go into. One is life. The challenges of being a scientist and just being a person in your society. The other one is the profession. What the challenges I've met in terms of my profession as a scientist and as a person of faith. I can't give a presentation and not talk about my living in this country in the history of slavery and racism. So I want to share some of what the challenges have been to be a scientist and the racism that is around us. And of course, I want to spend a lot of time talking about the challenges of not maintaining, but expressing my religion, my faith, my belief in God, and God's role in our lives as a scientist and in the scientist profession. So life. There are lots of challenges in life. We've all lived, so we know that's the case. And what I want to focus on now is not sort of the general kinds of issues that we confront as we move through life and as we move through life as Christians, but as being a scientist. And one of the challenges that I say I have had is that I'm always a scientist. The way I look at the world, whether we're talking about politics, or we're talking about finance, or we're talking about social issues, I approach it as a scientist. Curiosity, probing, criticism, wanting to understand. And so that can be a problem with people who don't understand that you're coming at it from that perspective. And so one of the things I have on the slide is my wife saying to me, I guess when our kids were maybe middle schoolers, do you have to be critical about everything? I don't know if you've gotten up or not, but I was like, what are you talking about? So yeah, everything we say is always like we got to go through this analysis. And I won't talk enough about Marion. I'm not here without her. But my wife says to me, she says, you know, the kids are not, they're not experienced, James. They're just two girls trying to grow up in the world. Stop analyzing everything about them. So this is a challenge because it's my nature. I think it's gotten me in trouble too in my profession. I like to think that I'm not judgmental, but I can be very critical of things. I want to understand them. Why is it this way? Why is it that? And I know there are people in this room like that too. So you need some feedback on this so that you can kind of try to modify. And what I've had to learn over the years is, what's the audience I'm talking with? Is this a okay place to ask this kind of question or not? So that's been a challenge for me. It remains a challenge. Even in my own profession, I think, sometimes when I first meet people, they think, oh my God, this guy just asked a thousand questions. But I want to understand. I want to know. I want to participate in the thinking and exchange. And so that's been a challenge. The other challenge I've had is with family and friends, is that I'm not the ideal scientist that they have in mind. You know, if you're not in this profession, you kind of think when science speaks, science knows. That's what you do. That's right. That's what it is. And we know that science is complicated and complex and nuanced, and we're not always sure. One of the examples I'd like to give is this. I used to teach environmental health science to undergraduates at MIT. I really enjoyed it. We talked about how do you determine whether or not something in the environment is causing a human health effect. Big challenging problem. What I used to tell them is this. So here's the problem with scientists that you're going to encounter. You talk to the persons who are in the company who are doing the polluting in a neighborhood, and they tell you, we're sure that the toxins, but the compounds are not causing any health effects. We're sure. You talk to the people who are living there, and they are like looking at their kids' leukemia, they think their cancer rates are high, and they're saying, we're pretty sure that those compounds that they're putting in our environment are hurting us. And then you get the environmental health scientists, and you ask them what they think about it, and what do we say? I'm sure. I'm not sure. Right? We can't tell you for sure. And that's not satisfying to anyone. But that's what science is like. Right? When you do it well, you understand the uncertainties in the process. And when you talk with people who are not scientists and you say things like that, they think you're crazy. They think you don't, actually you're being evasive. Or, you know, these questions that come up, one of the things going on right now in my neighborhood, you can imagine, is people talk about climate change and they're asking me, I says, well, you know, you don't vote in science. Right? Just because there are 100 people over here saying it's this, there's one over here, that one over there may actually be the one who's got it right. So that has been complicated for me in terms of dealing with my, again, family and friends, because I tend not to just sort of say, yeah, science says it must be right. No, science says it. We're using a different way of thinking about the problem or the issue, and we have to weigh that against other things, just like we weigh our science against our belief in Christ. We don't use it to say it is or isn't, or to try to falsify. We just recognize that it's a different kind of way of dealing with knowledge. The last thing I want to tell you about my life challenges is something that has to do with becoming a scientist, because I have spent most of my life in the past, not in the present, but in the future, thinking about how to prepare for what's next in my scientific trajectory. Thinking about how what I do now is going to impact later. And I'm going to give you an example of how lost I was about this. I'm not going to tell you how many times I've gone out and talked to young students about, you know, the five P's, preparation, persistence, but also, you know, planning for the future. So this is what changed me. Sitting at the dinner table one evening with my family, at the time my oldest daughter, Esha, was about 7 or 8. We were just having a conversation. And then Esha says, oh no, not the F word again. This is our anger. Right? I look at Mary. Do you know what she's talking about? Esha, what's the F word? And Esha says, Dad, you say it all the time. You know what it is.
She says, future. All we talk about is future. Future this, future that. Why can't we just talk about now?
The wisdom of children. And in that moment, I saw myself for what I was. You know, always tell me, you gotta do this now for that. It's really important, students, senior people here, it's important to be in the present. There's a role for planning for the future, but it's in the present where we interact with each other. It's in the present where we share. It's in the present where we help and support. If we spend all our time saying, I'm only doing this, what's gonna happen later on, you've lost something really important. And so now when I go out and talk to students, I actually talk about this specifically, about being in the present. And as scientists, because we're always thinking about where it's going, it's very important, but we have to spend some time thinking about what's happening in our present as well. I want to turn to percussion. And I put this way because this is my scientific life. The two things that are there are inseparable as far as I can tell in my own experience. And the one that you can't really see as well is this one. Now, there are lots of ways in which people differ from one another. And human beings have gotten very good at treating others unfairly or discriminating against them because they're different. Races, we'll get into talking about the scientific basis for race, but race is one of those differences. And I appreciate, and I've had some conversations here too, but there are lots of reasons why human beings are discriminating against one another. But what I want to submit to you is that this one in America is different. And the reason it's different, I think, and there may be some others like it, is because that type of discrimination and unfair treatment is based on questioning the humanity of the other. Right? This whole notion of the way often humans oppress other humans and they justify within their faith is by saying they're not really human. They are subhuman. And in the history of science, scientists have contributed to that approach. Right? So racism, I think, especially the imperative of the history of slavery in this country, makes it something we really have to pay much more attention to because it does impact all of us. Now, what I want to do in this moment in talking about this particular challenge is to say the relevance here to my Christian faith is because of the things I've encountered in this country, because of my race, I would not have gotten through them without God. I would not have gotten through any of these things that I'm not going to tell you about if it wasn't for my faith in God. That has really made a difference for me. It's given me a different kind of understanding about this. It's helped with the pain, it's helped with the anger, all of those types of things. What it's meant in my profession, racism, is that I've encountered, so Michael gave you that list of all the wonderful opportunities that I've had, right? So if you look at my career on paper, it looks just like he must have really had a great time going through. But I assure you that what's missing from there is all of the knots, the no's, and the no's. And it is chronic. I mean, so I thought about this a lot, and I didn't really come to a conclusion this morning about how to share this, because I could just give you like one example after another, and some of you would say, oh my goodness, that happened? And others you would say, well, you know, that could have happened to anybody. Right? But I'm telling you that many of these things that have happened that I'm going to just share a little bit about are because of racism. Now, the racism I'm talking about, I mentioned Kuhn early on, because talking about presenting new scientific ideas and having, going out and presenting, you know, new data, new findings, there's got to be resistance. What I want to tell you and share with you is that the resistance that I have encountered is beyond that. Some of it I understand now is because people just not being familiar with a different kind of person, different heritage, coming forth with new ideas, but there's a certain level of distrust because of being different. And that isn't unique to racism in science, but that's beyond what Kuhn talked about in terms of just the natural process of science and the natural vetting process that takes place before new paradigms can move forward. The other thing is that I read E.E. Just. I got the book E.E. Just from my godmother when I came to MIT. I didn't read it until the protest against racism that I undertook at MIT. I read it in that moment. And the thing that just boggled my mind is that in many places I could just put my own name in there 100 years earlier and it would be the same. The things that Just encountered in terms of his ability to have his research accepted, to get positions to do that research, to find funding for it. So there are only, so I want to share three things with you about my experience. I think some of you may be aware that I underwent a hunger strike for about 2 weeks at MIT to protest the racism in the denial of my tenure case. And I want to, again, emphasize again, I'll emphasize it in this way. So if you ask me, what counsel did you take, James, before you decided to do that? Who did you talk with? Did you talk with your wife about this? Did you talk with your pastor? Did you talk with your father? I didn't talk with but one entity, and that was God. The only counsel I took in making that decision was in my faith. It was the right thing to do. My wife is still getting over forgiving me for that, but she found out about it like everybody else when I announced it. And my faith told me that was the right way to proceed, and that's what I did. I have never looked back at that decision. So that's one thing about how racism has impacted me. The second thing is, what I didn't tell you in my journey of becoming a scientist, the thing that I've always wanted to be is an independent investigator. From the days when I wanted to come and be a microbiologist, I ended up being a cancer cell biologist. I just can't tell you how much my psyche is for being that. I love the interaction with students. The best people used to ask me, well, what's the best thing about being at MIT? The students. That opportunity to work with young minds, to train, to teach. So it's what I've always wanted to do. And what happened because of that protest is that I don't get to do that anymore. I've talked with some of you about what I do at Asymmetrics and how I enjoy it and it's important to me and everything, but I don't get to do the thing that I always wanted to do. Now, the third thing I want to tell you about this is that the other thing that changed because of that protest is how I pray. Some of you, I used to pray for things that I wanted and I hoped for. God, please let this happen. God, please do this, God. And now my prayer is, God, give me the joy of following whatever path you put before me. Give me the strength to do the things and the understanding to approach them the way you would have me to approach them. And that prayer really represents the fact that I learned from that experience. As my mom has always told me, she says, son, sometimes what you want is not what God has for you. And so it's really about, in my career now, saying, you never know what God actually has for you in mind, or if he's even thinking about what you're doing. But I hope to think that the things that I do and the way I proceed now, although I don't get to do what I wanted to do, are important that I'm doing what I am doing. So I want to move on now from that aspect of my life as a scientist and as a person, and I want to spend the rest of my time talking about the challenges of being a scientist with the faith that I have in God. And those are the elements that I want to go to. For me, as I said earlier at the beginning, it's always about the synthesis between science and faith. And I want to say this, Hope, the round tables that some of you participated in and the ones that we have back in the Northeast have been really a great place to have an expression of that. One of the challenges is this as a scientist. My thinking is, God gave us science. It must be okay to use it. even to ask questions about God. But, as you know, certainly in my church back at Oakville, if you say, I wonder if I could do an experiment to figure out and show how God is in the world, people would say, what are you talking about? Don't you just believe? Faith is all you need. I agree. Faith is all you need. But that doesn't mean you can't have the intellectual exercise of asking the question, how would you go about deciding what we feel, what we believe, what we think, demonstrating the existence of God in the world? We've had examples of that, miracles in the past. God has done that for us. But I like that idea of like, apply the scientific method. Don't worry. We're not going to falsify the existence of God. It's not going to happen. We may discover something more about our world by taking our tools that we've been given and applying them. I really enjoyed the talk last night thinking about other aliens and Deborah's thinking about how that relates to our worldview here now. So that's something that I continuously think about. You know, how does the science and the existence of God go together? Now, it may be, as I will agree, that maybe you can't really investigate God because God actually gave us the investigatory tool. Now, one of the issues that comes up is talking about your religion and you all is private versus public. So it's one thing to maintain your faith for yourself, within your church family, and your society. It's another thing to go out and talk about your Christian faith at one of your scientific conferences that isn't the ASAP. Right? We know those challenges that are there. And once you go out and you start talking in public about issues where science and religion play a role, the public arena can be a really kind of threatening place. Right? One of the things that I've seen is that in the debates I participated in around the science of human life, of humanity, is that the moment a scientist, in my experience, so I'll give you what it's like. You're in a compound debate discussing an issue. Somebody from the audience, usually a reporter, says, isn't your father a Baptist minister? Or, aren't you a member? When that happens, the reason that question is asked, because then everybody in the room stops listening to anything you've got to say about science. That's something we have to change. It has to be understood that my faith does not mean that I don't practice scientific method like everyone else and apply the same rules and requirements, because I don't. Right? It doesn't invalidate my contributions in the area of science because I'm a believer in God and Christ. But I tell you right now, amongst many, when you talk about the fact that you believe in something that you cannot show and let someone else touch and feel it the way you do, your scientific credibility, you can sort of hear it just plummeting. And so it's been a challenge for me to think about how to manage that. And then I'll tell you that if you look at some of the things that I've written in these areas, I'm going to skip beyond science and humanity and go to negotiating moral versus ethical. And talking about how, based on science, we think people should behave about the treatment of individuals, the treatment of embryos, those types of things. You can talk in the scientific community about ethics. Because ethics is something that we agree upon, right? The ethic can be a good ethic, it can be a bad ethic. You know, thieves have ethics, right? We can define it. And if you look at the regulations about, again, the treatment of early humans and unborn children in the scientific regulations like NIH and like that, they talk about ethical science. What's missing is moral science, right? What's hard to do is to bring to bear a foundation, a basis that's actually based on talking about what's good and what's bad, what's good and what's evil, what's right and what's wrong. But in our faith, we know that there is good and there is evil. Trying to bring that to bear in scientific discussions is quite challenging. And one of the things I've been looking at is how to, so I was going to say earlier, looking at my writing, it talks about this is whether this is ethical or unethical. But in fact, what I'm thinking is whether this is moral or immoral. And trying to move that into the public arena is quite challenging. And it's something I think it, groups like this have to think about how to do that. So the science that I've really been participating in has to do with education around what is the nature of human life, its beginning and its end. And again, there have been challenges there too. And I say to people sometimes when I'm involved in these discussions, I say, you know, I want to talk about what we as scientists know. I want to be truthful about what we as scientists know. And then the public can make a decision about how it wants to behave and policies that are written based on that. But it's very challenging to also say in the same breath that I don't think God wants us to be doing what we're doing when it comes to how we treat fetuses and how we use fetuses for doing research and how we destroy embryos for youngsters for research. I don't believe that is right. But what I try to do in the public arena is to say, let us make sure at least you're getting a fair and truthful statement about what we know as scientists about this. So I want to close with this slide here. By telling you, I hope you take from my talk, that I view my opportunity in life to be a scientist as a blessing. It's a very special profession that we can take in. In my life, and as I move forward, I want to continue to try to not talk about science versus faith, but science and faith. I wasn't aware of the ASA the way I'm becoming aware of it now, and gee whiz, I wish I knew this organization when I headed out for college. I really wish that. And I will tell many of my students about this. Scientists have a social responsibility because of our profession. We are the keepers of the tree of knowledge. We are the cultivators of it. All sorts of knowledge about how the world works. And although we started out by doing some things that God didn't want us to do in terms of eating from that tree, we are now its stewards. Many of you may be like me. I am trained. My education is paid for by the public. Scholarships, fellowships. And I feel a responsibility because of that to give back in terms of helping the public to understand what it is we do and why we do the things we do. And to help inform the various processes that have to do with things that have to do with how we treat one another in this world. And so I come with the close that I aspire for moral science. A science where we can apply this tool, this wonderful approach of understanding the world, and do it from the perspective of what we think God would have of us to do. That there are appropriate and inappropriate things to do with our tools. Right? And if we can do that, problems like discrimination, unfair treatment, many of those will fall away as well. And the bottom line is, forget about the science. It's about putting God in our lives and what we do. So I want to thank you for the time and for your attention. And I'm happy to address questions and comments. I look forward to talking with you in the meeting. And let me just say, I'm available to you for these issues and others after I leave here. My email address, please reach out to me. I hope I will join and see you guys in the future. So God bless and God keep you. Thank you.
Thank you so much. You began by thanking the organizers for giving you an opportunity to share your story that you hadn't been asked to share that before, but I have to say I'm personally very grateful to you for your vulnerability and for sharing your story and your perspective with us. It's really beautiful, beautiful talk. We do have time for a few questions. So we've got a couple folks out with microphones. If you have a question, please wave your hand. I'll start while you're getting your question warmed up. I'm curious if you reflect on if your personal experience as an African American and your particular sensitivity to past injustices, both with slavery in general and difficulties between the African American community and science in particular, and difficult stories in our history on that. Do you think that makes you personally more sensitive to issues of injustice and the ethical concerns that you share at the end?
Yes, is the short answer. I have seen these issues around how we treat unborn children as equivalent to the problems of racism. One of the things that happened early on is the confusion of science around whether or not embryos are human beings. What kinds of humans are they? And the same kind of, it's the same kind of victimization that you see. And so in my view, I see them as the same. It's the same kind of basic problems, and science is playing the same roles in terms of having confused the issue of what we sort of know. Common sense tells us, but when you're in a place where you discover you've been doing something that wasn't right, and you feel bad about it, it's nice to have a rationalization and say, well, maybe it was okay. And the same kinds of issues and dynamics, I think, are happening around the issue of nascent human life as well. So yes, I think it has made me more sensitive on both sides of things, recognizing it represents the same difficulties in our society.
Yeah. Other questions? Question way in the back. Oh, up here, somebody up here.
I just want to thank you because you are a stream of living water. I'm thinking about how the Bible says bitterness, the root of bitterness defiles many, and somehow you have forgiven your enemies like Jesus, and you are a stream of living water, and I personally thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
Right.
Yes, thank you for coming in.
Okay.
Thank you for coming and sharing your life with us. I'm really interested in your idea of moral science and how we can further that conversation in the public life. And I guess my question is, what are your initial thoughts of how we as scientists can do that without immediately being discredited in the public sphere for saying something about our faith?
Yeah. So I think it's like most things in life, and you're trying to bring forward either a misunderstood or disliked perception. Don't do it alone. Try to do it with God, and you're not alone there, but also with others. That's why organizations like this are really important. So I think that the important thing is to sort of do it as a body. And you have to sort of put a message out that is consistently there, right? And so that message is having scientists who are of faith explaining why there need not be any tension there, and explaining to others what's the benefit of moving to understanding that science can really help us to inform doing good. So it's not easy, it hasn't been easy. It's not like there hasn't been any progress in this area, but I think it's something we have to sort of do deliberately.
Yeah. And the man who taught me geology on the right, on the way over here.
No, geology. Hi, folks. I'm retired from Wheaton College, Jeff Weaver, but I look across this wonderful sea of faces and heads, many of which I know. But notice how gray and one gender, how bald it is. You know, it's wonderful to see us come together in fellowship and to listen to Dr. Brother James here preaching some really good stuff. But I want to challenge all of us. I'm not on the program here this meeting, but I've been at Wheaton College for, I don't know, 34 years. I want to challenge us, mature individuals, that we are preaching to the choir, you know. And to hear that one question come up from a younger voice is extremely important. We have really got an obligation to do in taking it beyond what we hear today. And almost a little model of the Bible, the guy, you know, looks at his face in the mirror and forgets it, because we get so many things, we get preached too beautifully, but how often do we actually do something and act on what we hear? And I'm pushing something, I'm actually selling something. There's a website called Call to Science. And the idea is that we really have to make what we're doing here viral among young Christian people. We have to take the zeal and the things that we're learning from these beautiful speakers and make it bear fruit. And we can't just do it in our own little fellowship groups. It's wonderful, it's glorious, but we have an obligation. We have to take what you just heard and everything that we do this week, and we have to spread it. It's an obligation, it's a challenge to all of us. So please take that challenge. Talk to the young people. Make people into apprentices. The idea of mentoring again is very important, so I put a plug in for that. Thanks for the inspiration.
All right, Darren, there were a few questions in the back. If you can make your way back there, but while you're making your way, I think there's a question over there.
Thank you, Dr. James, for your talk. It was wonderfully inspirational. Many of us work at predominantly white institutions, and many of us would like to see that change, and there's the systemic racism that is still with us. Can you give us, what's your best advice for bringing about change? Do it together, you already said, but are there other steps?
And I'll expand that also to the ASA. How can we be more welcoming here?
So I think of these problems probably too simplistically, but I think they're pretty simple. Invite, welcome. You have to also recruit. Because just like I wasn't aware of what's happening at Union College, probably not just African Americans, but probably many other students are. So you have to look amongst yourselves and say that it would be a good thing if our institution looked more like America. I don't know, maybe it should look more like, but have more diversity. And then at that moment, you have to tell people that. You have to put programs in place that say, we'd like to have a more diverse place. We'd like to have people that aren't currently participating with us come join us. And then you have to take care of people when they get there. And I'll tell you this, not everybody in your institution feels the way you do. And those of you who feel that this is an important thing to do, you have to look out for bringing in those new people. Just like when new members come into this group, you've got to take care of them. You've got to realize that not everybody has your view. Maybe you're moving people in that direction. You've got to protect people, help them, support them. And then you have to involve them, right? So nothing's better when you're trying to build that kind of recruitment than have people go through and learn about what the goodness is there to invite other people. So it's a process that you have to invest in doing. Please don't minimize what individuals do when they do it as a collective. Right? Think about your own world, your own network. Tell people about what you're trying to accomplish here. Ask them. If you know someone who might come here and do well, thrive well here, that we'd like to have them, it's work. The other thing you can do is you can look around the country and find out the places that are succeeding and ask them, what are your practices? How did you go about starting doing this? All of those are factors, but I think the most important thing is that you have to start someplace. Thanks for that question.
We have time for maybe two more questions.
Okay.
Paul?
Dr. Shirley, yes. I have a scientific question.
Yeah.
I'm not a biologist, but I remember about 10 years ago, ASA had an annual meeting with a focus on the issue of stem cells and trying to come up with somatic pluripotent stem cells so that we do not have the ethical issues, moral issues. Can you update me on where we stand with that technology, Jenna?
So, two things. So, some of you may be aware, we're about 10 years out now, I guess, of something called induced pluripotent stem cells. Those are artificially stem cells made by taking genes and putting them into any mature tissue that's not a stem cell. And by doing that, you can get cells which are part and parcel pretty much like embryonic stem cells. So it allows embryonic stem cell scientists to keep doing their development work without doing development without there being a person involved. Right? So
that has become our hottest industry now. And although there are still some holdouts there, we still need to disrupt the embryos and make them run stem cells, but they're not quite the same. Much of the research world has moved to induced glucose stem cells, and they're not ideal. There are some problems, but the problems with them are the same problems that they're running with embryonic stem cells. Now, the other cell type, which is the stem cells that are in our bodies now, that don't pose ethical issues as long as we are good about making consent and thinking about what we do with them. They're still challenging to work with. They're still challenging to enumerate how good they are, to make more of them. Those are research problems, but they don't pose any ethical problems. The big issue right now, as you can, I think many of you know, is not so much with what's happened with the production and the use of embryonic or stem cells. This is about what's being done in terms of engineering embryos, in terms of genome editing. That process is now a really important issue that is, as I say, that train is already down the tracks. But that doesn't mean that we can't run and catch up with it and think about what direction it's going in and that type of thing. We have to sort of do that. That's going on now as well.
Okay, last question will be the first hand I saw, which is all the way in the back, and then we'll have, it was, yeah, George.
Taking it in a slightly different direction, you raised the question of investigating God scientifically.
Yes.
Investigating God's action in the world. And I know some people are trying to do experiments on the success of prayer, things like that. It would seem to me that the prohibition, you shall not put the Lord your God to the test, would be a basic problem with that approach.
I suppose it would. Can I ask a question myself?
Yeah.
Does Sam have a question before we go?
Yeah, go ahead.
Thanks so much for sharing your story. As a younger scientist just finishing up my PhD and looking to start a career soon, I was wondering if you had any advice on navigating science and faith versus science versus faith conversations with our colleagues or supervisors or even students.
Yeah. All right, so this is going to seem like maybe a trivial response, but start the conversation. So here's the thing. Oftentimes, when we're in our academic setting, we just don't know how that student, that professor, that colleague feels about this. We can try to listen. I heard about listening. You might discover, oh yeah, they talk about the fact that they go to this particular church or something, and then you maybe can start a conversation about that. But you start by just taking the risk of sharing. When I was a professor and mentor students, one of the best things that ever happened was when I discovered a student was a student of faith. Because it gave me something else to work with them with. Without having to be concerned about maybe offending someone else who, or even annoying someone else because of me bringing to bear prayer. So I think it's challenging, but in your interpersonal relationships, you simply have to try sharing and try asking. Something wrong with asking, hey, how do you feel about the Lord? You'll know right away from that person when you ask that question what's going to happen with that. And I'm going to say one more thing. The round tables, which some of you participated in, they're about helping with getting those conversations happening amongst academic faculty in the sciences. Ones who are not necessarily believers, the ones who are. One of the things I've learned in those meetings is that oftentimes people who are believers, they don't know each other either. Right? So it's about that kind of opportunity to broaden and improve our lives by having those interactions in the places where we spend most of our time working. So try that, sir.
So I did see more hands up. Please ask those questions of each other or of our speaker maybe later during the conference. Now we're going to adjourn this meeting to the poster session, which will be in the basement of Meyer. So let's keep the conversation going down there.
Great. Thank you.